Let's talk tech.
Hi guys, you are listening to Let's Talk Tech, episode 8. Let's talk HCI. Now, I'm going to leave that to our guest for today. That's in terms of breaking it down and even just telling us what it means. Yes, guys, it's been a while. It's Tolu that's talking here, in case any of you are not familiar with our voices yet. And I must say to begin that Tammy did such a great job with that blockchain episode, didn't she? Tammy, what do you think?
Just review yourself.
Give yourself feedback.
I haven't been able to listen to it. I listened to it when I was editing. Apart from that, I haven't listened to the whole episode. I don't think I can. I'm sick of hearing my voice and only my voice. So that's all I have to say. Yeah. It was good. I enjoyed speaking to Gozier, and yeah, I learned a lot about blockchain, and I think I actually understand it now, which is pretty cool. So I recommend, if you haven't listened, please go check it out. And it's definitely a technology that is here to stay. It's not a gimmick. So it's good to be informed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it was really interesting to hear about like the different applications apart from Bitcoin.
really
insightful episode.
All the stuff you were saying about the medical uses, cybersecurity, and even some of the financial applications outside of just cryptocurrency. So yeah, definitely worth listening to. Check it out, guys.
Yeah, check it out. Yes, guys, before we move on to introducing you to our lovely guest, we just want to give a shout out to all the girls in tech. So by the time that we're recording this episode, at the beginning of the week, we had the International Day of the Girl Child, and the theme for this year was digital generation, our generation. And really, I guess the premise of this was just to really see how much of awareness could be raised for girls to get more access to the internet, digital devices, which is really cool. And in case you haven't noticed yet, this is an all-girl episode, all-woman episode, you know, whoop, girls whoop. Ruling the world type thing. Whoop, whoop. So, yeah. So, guys, you're in for a ride. Enough of me talking. Belinda, please introduce yourself to us. Yeah, tell us about yourself.
Hi, guys. Thank you, Tim. Yeah, my name is Oyin Williams. I currently work as a UX designer and researcher at the Honeycomb Works. I have a cocktail of skills. I have worked across different roles in tech. I've worked as a developer, as a digital marketer, as a graphic designer, brand designer, and now a UX designer. So as you can see, it's just like a lot of things that I have done. Yeah, so before my work here at the Honeycomb Works, I recently finished my master's in human-computer interaction. So yay.
Congrats.
Yeah.
Thank you.
If you've ever done a master's in the UK, you would appreciate this, I'm telling you.
Yeah, it was intense. Yeah, so kind of my background, I started by studying information and communication science in Nigeria. So what led me to doing that is a very interesting story. So I'm not one of those people who has always liked computers, because usually when you ask people how they got into tech, it's like, oh, I've always loved computers. That was not my situation. I was deathly afraid of computers. And I think yes, I had a phobia for them because the primary school I went to, the secondary school I went to, there was kind of like this guarded attitude towards computers. It was like, oh, the computers are there, don't touch them, you know, just go into the computer lab, sit down, shut up, listen to your teacher, take your notes, don't touch anything, don't break anything. So whenever I was with computers, that feeling was always there. It was like, oh, don't touch anything, this is a very complicated machine that you shouldn't, you know, just do anything with. An example of a situation that I was in where that feeling was reinforced. So we had a computer lab session. So we were preparing for an exam. And I don't know what happened. I don't know what we did to that computer, me and one of my friends. And the computer just did something bizarre that I wasn't expecting. And
everyone was like,
and I was like, oh my God, I shouldn't have done anything to this thing. So it was a friend of mine who, Timmy knows, she was more familiar with computers and she was the one who did something. And, you know, it was back to normal. And I think just thinking about that experience really helps me understand why it is important that people know how to use technology, why we have to make sure that technology is easy for people to use. We don't want people to use technology and feel stupid, or we don't want people to feel like it's too complicated. But I guess I'm getting ahead of myself. So
That's really cool.
I like that. I like that link between how you felt then and what you do now. That's really, really cool.
Yeah.
And when it was time for me to do a degree, my undergraduate, so I didn't really know exactly what I wanted to do, but I knew what I did not want to do. I knew I did not want to be a doctor.
You're in the right place, Timmy.
You also wanted to be a doctor?
No.
Oh, you did not want to be a doctor?
Nah, we did not want to be doctors.
Yeah, so I was, you know, trying to figure out what I wanted to do. Engineering was like a very interesting prospect for me, but the different parts of engineering, I just did not understand. I didn't want to be a civil engineer because I was afraid of heights. I didn't want to be an electrical engineer because I didn't know what that was. And so when I was going through the brochure and I saw information and communication science, it was like, I have no idea what this is, but it's like sufficiently mysterious enough for me to want to find out what it is. And it was like, okay, so I don't like computers, but I would like to want to be able to be comfortable with computers. And I guess that was like kind of like my journey into becoming like this computer nerd that I am now. And, you know, when I finally got a computer and I was able to, you know, play around with it, it was fascinating to me. Learning about technology, when I started my course, learning about technology, learning about how important technology is and how technology makes things so possible. I think that was something that was very interesting to me. That was something that really attracted me. How technology makes things possible, you know, how it helps people do things, how it helps people solve problems. I did HCI in my second year in uni, and I was instantly in love with it, which was one of the reasons why I decided to pursue it as a master's. Yeah, so I guess that's kind of like the journey. So when I finished my undergraduate, I started working as a developer. I worked as a web developer. I learned graphic design in school. So the thing with Nigerian schools is that even if you study a tech course, and I think it's not just Nigerian schools, I think generally, even if you study a computer science degree or a tech-related degree, there is a level of self-directed learning that you still have to do. You still have to make sure that, you know, you are learning the skills. You have to make sure that you are teaching yourself, even though, you know, the curriculum is there for you. So there was a lot of self-learning for me. I taught myself how to code. I taught myself how to design, you know, and all those things. So, yeah, I started working as a developer and then went for my master's in human-computer interaction. And now I am a UX designer and researcher.
Awesome.
That is so cool. I think it's so unique in that, like, you started from not liking computers, being intrigued.
Being afraid.
Being afraid, actually. Being intrigued and saying, actually, I want to be comfortable with this. I want to learn more about it. And then, you know, you went through self-learning, building those skills up yourself. I think that's really impressive. Well done.
Yeah, and I think it reinforces something we're always saying, like, not everyone's journey or path into tech looks the same, I think.
Yeah. Exactly, yeah.
Yeah, some people, they just love it from the moment, whatever. Some people they never liked it. They just kind of stumbled into it. And then some people actively pursued, like, actually, I want to understand this. So, yeah, wherever you're at, there's a route in if you want one, really.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. And it sounds like quite a number of the things that you're involved in, there's that creative element, isn't there?
Mm.
Yeah,
because I hear a lot of design,
yeah,
graphics, creativity. It seems you're quite a creative person.
That's
something I've always been, you know, just having that creative flair and just wanting to build things, wanting to create something.
Mm.
I think one of the things that made UX very fascinating for me was that it's very encompassing. So it takes understanding, you know, you understand how the underlying technology works, you understand people, you understand the design elements to it. And I think when I started, you know, doing UX, it made sense. You know, it made sense because it had there were so many things involved, and so I've always been that person.
Okay, I'll stop you there because you're straying into the territory that we all love so much. It's the main, as we like to call it, the meat of the episode. So this is where we would ask you to please explain to us, what is HCI? And you've alluded to UX, UI. So what are those also? How do they interact with HCI? Please break it down for us. That is the trademark of this season. So please break down HCI for us.
All right, sure. Yeah, so HCI is human-computer interaction. So as a field, HCI kind of emerged out of different fields. So it takes from psychology, it takes from computer science, it takes from engineering, ergonomics, cognitive psychology, behavioral science, and just brings everything together. And the aim of HCI is, as the name implies, you know, helping people as humans interact with computers and with technologies, is making that process easy for them. The key word when it comes to HCI is usability, is making technologies usable for people. So the history behind it was that initially, so before now, computers were, you know, the way I envisioned it before when I was younger, it's like this ginormous, you know, things that people could not understand. And the people who could actually operate computers were programmers and IT professionals who would just, you know, write code before they could carry out certain, you know, actions on the computer. And it was when Macintosh came in the 1970s that they said, look, we have to make this more accessible for lay people. And that was where kind of what HCI came from, is like, how can we take this, you know, lines of code that people have to write, you know, to access their computer, how can we make that easier for people? And then they started with the graphical user interfaces, you know, with the icons and the windows and the desktop. So it was from that, as you look at the research in HCI or the history as HCI has progressed, every stage HCI has been involved in that. So when we went to social computing, with social media, with the internet, and people using more of that, you could see that there were different parts of that, that people needed to be able to use those technologies in a way that was useful for them, in a way that was enjoyable for them, in a way that was also, that also paid attention to them as a person, to their well-being. And then, you know, you look at gesture-based interaction, and now with AI, with augmented reality and virtual reality. So just to say that every step of that process, HCI has been involved. It's kind of like the research that it starts with that, the research, and then it goes into industry. So many of the things that we are familiar with today, when we look at, for example, the links that we use, hypertext technology, how that, you know, you click on a link, it takes you to another page. That started as a research in a lab, you know, by HCI researchers, and it went through lots of testing, lots of research. So it's just to say that the little things, the little technology interactions that we have now, were not always that way. And they came about because of research, because someone said, hey, how can we take understanding of humans, understanding of, you know, how they operate, understanding of their physical capabilities, understanding of their mental capabilities, understanding of the technology, and then how can we make that experience a seamless process for them? So that's kind of like what HCI aims to accomplish.
Nice. I love that definition. I really, really do. And I just realized something. When you said Macintosh, I was like, yes, of course, Steve Jobs. How did I know? Yeah. Makes huge sense. Was Steve Jobs really into HCI and like employing researchers for Apple? Because I think Apple for a long time were at the forefront of kind of bringing the user experience and merging that with technology. Because prior to that, Windows, like Linux, Ubuntu, all the other operating systems, they're focused on programmers and enabling you to get the best out of a computer. So computational, you're writing code. Like literally, it was just, Linux is still just code-based. It's not for user experience or anything like that. And the Mac kind of changed it. Then Windows had to like get on board.
Exactly. And that was one of the things that really contributed to their massive success, because they were paying attention to the user. One of the things that people say in the UX community is like, you know, it's all about the user. It's all about the user. But when you put the user first, when you make sure that people are having a good experience with your technology, the money will follow. When I used to use Spotify, free Spotify before. But then I realized that this experience is so amazing. I don't mind paying for it. I don't mind paying every month for it. And there are people like that, that they say, okay, because this technology is so easy to use, because this technology solves my problems, I'm willing to pay for that. So when those technology companies, you know, the Apples, the Microsoft, the IBMs, when they started looking at the user side of their technology, you see that the money followed. And they became, you know, rich or wealthy leaders in their industry. Yeah.
No, it makes sense. Because I remember when the first iPhone came out, before that, BlackBerry was like the leader in the mobile phone space, right? And it was keyboard screen, fairly small screen. And then Apple took away the keyboard. And I remember the first, I still remember vividly, the first reactions were like, how are you going to take away the keyboard? What are people going to use? But like you said, Apple tapped into the fact that for a user, it's a better experience if they actually have more screen. And then when they need the keyboard will be on screen. And obviously that revolutionized mobile phone as we know it. And now you're hard pressed to find any phone with a hardware keyboard. And now when I use them or look at them, it just seems so foreign. But yeah, it's quite fascinating.
And I think audacious. I was going to say that I think that was really like audacious.
It was.
At such a time, because like, you know, they were like the frontliners. No one else had done that before. So to see like that adoption, you know, that quick adoption. I mean, I guess it wasn't so quick, but like over time, now you see that like other phone providers or, you know, mobile devices are, you know, digital and without
following. And that was also going to speak to that, that companies like that, like Apple, who follow research, who have like a very detailed thought process to their technologies, or you call them industry leaders, when they do things, every other person follows. Like with the iPods, for instance, when they first brought it out, a lot of companies were making fun of them. Samsung, for instance, they had like,
I'm not going to use that.
Like, why would you cut the wire?
Exactly. And now they are the ones copying what iPhone is doing. And that kind of like speaks to how the interaction between industry and HCI. So HCI is not principally an industry-based field. It's more focused on research, understanding not just present technology, but also envisioning future technologies. So what industry, what companies will do is they will take research that already exists and then bring it to the commercial space. So UX, user experience, for those who don't know what UX is, user experience design is kind of like, you could say, a subset or an industry application of HCI. HCI researchers can work, or someone who studied HCI can work in different roles. So UX is one of them. And taking those principles out of academia, taking those principles out of, you know, being just that, and then applying it in industry is kind of like what you would call, I guess, the symbiotic relationship, you know, between HCI and industry work.
It's really interesting. I think there's a lot of research going on, say, for example, with AI. And not as much, maybe I would say, anyone can argue, not as much like proof to back up, like, you know, some of the research, but it is good to identify HCI as, you know, having that constant and practical use of like what's being found out from research, UTC. So that is good.
Yeah, it's interesting that you mentioned HCI. HCI and AI. So, you know, initially what I said was that as technology advanced, you know, HCI was kind of like in the process every step of the way with the different generations of technology. And so we are in the, I guess you could say, the AI generation.
Yeah.
And HCI is also in that because it's, so a field in HCI or research in HCI is explainable AI, which was one of the research work I did, which is about improving trust that people have with AI systems by making sure that AI is not just the black box. So black box in AI talks about how that the algorithms behind what the decisions AI brings out, the algorithms are not, they're not transparent. People cannot see how the system came about that decision. So for people to trust the AI system, they need to know the, I guess you could say, the thought process behind that system. So what explainable AI does is to give users that explanation, is to say, okay, so we are saying that it's going to, the price, for instance, of flight is going to change next tomorrow because of so-so and so. And then you are presenting that information in such a way that it considers the users, their expertise, their situation, and just, you know, how to display that information in a good way that people can say, oh, yeah, I understand why that this algorithm, I understand why this system came about this final solution, and I can trust it. Because if I don't know why, if I don't know how it did it, I can't trust it. So that's just like that human element behind it. So that's just like, I guess you can see another relationship between HCI and AI.
Okay, that's interesting. We're getting even more than we bargained for. That's good. You've talked about HCI. You've done a really, really great job breaking it down. And I think it is important to note that I don't think we had to stop you much to say, oh, what is that? Break that down, please. You did use everyday terms to really explain and to bring it home. So thank you. Yeah. So what are some of the real life applications of HCI that you can mention? I believe you already kind of touched on that also with, for example, with Tim bringing up the example of BlackBerry and moving to smartphones. Yes. Well, yeah, are there any other real-life applications that you can point out to really understand it better?
Yeah, there are a couple of things that I can't think about. One of the things that I would say in terms of how kind of the work in HCI plays into the things that we currently do is, so like I said, HCI is a cocktail of so many different fields, you know, the computer science, engineering, psychology. So cognitive psychology, for instance, there are several research I have been done in cognitive psychology about understanding humans. For instance, human memory, the way we process information as human beings is fascinating, but it's also limited. So we have what we call, you know, your sensory memory, you have your working memory, and then you have your long-term memory. So your working memory is limited. It's kind of like the RAM of your system. It's like the temporary memory. And then for people to be able to use your system, you have to make sure that you are catering to that limitation that people have. You don't assume that people will remember anything. So taking from that theory of cognitive load that has been done in psychology and taking that into how we build our systems is, for instance, there's a new thing that apps do now. Well, it's not so new, where if you're on your banking app and then they ask you for an authentication code, they send it to your messaging app. You have to go to your messaging app and kind of memorize that code and then go back to the app and then put that code. But because of research in that cognitive load theory, knowing that there is a limit to what we can hold in our memory, technology, you know, we say, okay, why don't we make that process automated? Immediately the message comes, it just copies it for you, and then you can proceed with. So just reducing the load that people have to keep in their mind while they are using the system. This is just one of many examples of the very little details in how technology is designed that just comes from HCI and UX and just understanding people. For every feature that a company like Apple brings out, for example, their pointer, it's like they went through that video and it's like years of research and testing. And it sounds very simple, but a lot of thought had gone into it. So another example that I can give is with ATMs. So when you go to an ATM, you put in your card and you type in whatever you're typing in, and then you get your money. But before you get your money, you get your card first before your money comes. So it wasn't always like that. I know in Nigeria, for instance, you get your card, you get your money, and then you get your card. But then there was, I think it was in Argentina, America, where they found out that people were constantly leaving their cards in the ATM once they got their money. So once they withdrew the money, they would leave their cards. And that was because understanding human psychology is that when you're going to that ATM, you have a goal in mind. Your goal is to get the money. And then once you're done with that task, you get the money and then you leave and then you forget your card. So when designers looked at that, they were like, okay, this is what is happening. Why not give them the card first? And because their mind is thinking, my goal is the money, they wait to get that money. They won't leave the money behind and take the card. Whereas the other way around, they would take the money and leave the card behind. So just like those little things here and there that kind of speaks to how for us to build technology that people will use, for us to build technology that people will find useful.
Yeah.
It has to be considerate of who people are, considerate of what they are, what their goals are, what their needs are. And sometimes even anticipating those needs. Companies like Google, for instance, it's like they roll out a feature and you're like, I didn't know I needed this in my life. But then you're using it and it's like, it makes total sense. Yep. Because they have done so much research, you know, they understand people and they are like, okay, yeah, because of this, because of this design, we can confidently give them these features.
Yeah, like one of my favorite features from my banking app, and I think they won an award either last year or the year before for like best banking app. And I wasn't surprised because they introduced this feature where you don't need your card and you can withdraw from a cash machine. So I used it this weekend because I don't carry my card around with me anymore because I can use near field to pay for something. And I love it because that means I don't have to carry a purse. I don't have to carry a bag. I can travel light. So I can go up to a machine using my app. I get a code, I enter it into the machine, it gives me my cash, and then I go on my way. And I love it. And it's like the feeling where you said they create a feature before you know you even need it. So carrying your card to get cash was standard, right? I was fine with that. I didn't like it, but I was fine with it. And then they released this feature, and I was like, yes, I've always wanted this. And now, now I always use it. And yeah, you're so right. Like, it's really understanding, and that's really understanding your users. They must have done some deep research.
Exactly.
To understand that. Because as far as I know, not a lot of banks are even doing it still.
They're
a traditional bank. I think they're the only traditional bank that does it. So yeah, that just sprung to mind when you said that specific phrase, because it's definitely something that I've noticed.
Yeah. And that is something that I think many companies, like we said earlier on, with, you know, Apple and all the big companies, why they are so successful, because they give people what people need, what people want, what people don't even know that they need even before, you know, they make those needs known, because they have done research, because they have carefully designed it. It's a science, actually. It's like, there's a process. So when we talk about UX, for instance, there is a process, you know, that happens, like the first stage, understand the user, you know, empathize with them, do this, create a prototype, you know, test with people, and then you go back, you keep. So it's kind of like, you can say, this agile process of, you know, testing and retesting and just, So companies that are conscious of that, companies that put that in the forefront, would consistently be ahead. And even as we think of future technologies to come, which HCI is currently thinking about, there's lots of research going on now in affective computing, for instance. So affective computing is about understanding people's emotions and how technologies can respond to people's emotions. There is research going on in, you know, IoT, in AI, like we've said earlier, in augmented reality and virtual reality. So it's about looking at this technology. It's not about making people work for the technology. It's about making the technology work for people. It's about making sure that this technology that we're building, how is it solving people's problems? And once you follow the user, the money will follow eventually. So,
I think the last thing I'd like to probably touch on in terms of real life applications, probably I'm actually curious to know more in terms of the hardware side of things, because I do understand that there's that element of work that has to be done as well. For example, I struggle, since we're talking about ATMs, sometimes I struggle with knowing, like, you know how there are buttons on the side and there are some of them that they're touch screen. And some have books, so sometimes it's like really confusing to know, okay, where do I press? I don't know if anyone else like has that issue, but this is a usability issue, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It is. And that it's interesting that you bring that up, because there are lots of also non-digital, in quotes, technologies that are poorly designed. So like the self-checkout system at supermarkets, some supermarkets, I'm not going to call names, some supermarkets have really good UX in terms of how their self-checkout systems work. For some, it's just like, you're just making me feel stupid. And I'm not stupid. I know. I know how to use things. And you never want people to feel that way. You never want your users to feel that way. You never want them to feel like they have to get a manual to figure things out. So I think, yeah, like you said, it is a usability issue. It's not just about the apps. It's not just about the AIs and the SaaS and all that. It's about wherever there is technology.
Yeah.
And this is very important to understand. Wherever there is technology, there is HCI, regardless of what that technology looks like, which I think is important to state if one is thinking of going into such a field. It's about, even as a UX designer, you don't have to focus on, oh, I'm building apps. Why not look at other types of technology? How can I build that technology for people? How can I make it easier for people to use?
That's such a nice way to wrap it up. Thank you. So moving on, I know we've touched on real life applications, but what are some of your favorite ones that and that you have personally worked on?
I think the most interesting, which will probably sound weird, was my dissertation. It was That's a lovely fine. Relationship. it was very intense. It was a lot of work, but it was quite interesting. And
well, to be honest, I know how that feels. Your dissertation or your master's thesis or whatever it's called, you just put so much of yourself into it.
You have to like it.
You have to love
exactly.
it. But then you hate it also because of the amount of yourself that you had to put into it.
Exactly. Yeah. You get it. Yeah.
So tell us, what was it about?
So it was an adaptive gamified. So I'm just going to kind of summarize what that was about. It's like, are you familiar with what gamification is? Or I have to explain.
I'm patiently
Please
waiting.
Break down.
So gamification is games are very motivating generally. So people are very engaged when they're playing games. They feel like the world falls away and they are in the game. So that motivating effect of games, that engaging effect of games, is like
you want to get to the next level.
Exactly.
Yeah.
The challenge, the immersion in the activity itself.
Yeah, like taking that. Sorry to delay you.
Right.
Do you remember Candy Crush when everyone was like obsessed with getting to like the next level?
Yes, that was me. Yeah, yeah. It's like you have this, is it adrenaline or is it serotonin?
Is it the dopamine? Like, is it the dopamine? Like, what is that
dopamine? Exactly, it's dopamine effect.
Yeah.
When you complete that level.
And also because like, yeah, exactly. When you complete that level, it's
it
like,
just like,
you
know, flows through your body. You're like, I want it again. I want
it. Yeah. And before you know it, 1 hour is gone and then you are still playing games. And just, It's really fascinating because even if they don't pay you to play games, nobody pays anybody to play games. Even if you're not getting paid, because that activity is in itself enjoyable for you, because there is an element of psychology there that has been built into that. It's like it's about the balance of challenge and skill. You know, when you feel like this is challenging for me and I have the skill, you know, to carry this out. So taking those core principles, those core psychological theories the principles of gaming and taking that and applying it to non-game context, that is essentially what gamification is. So an example that I can give is Strix. If you use Duolingo, who uses Duolingo?
I have in the past. Yeah,
I've tried in my various attempts to learn French, learn Spanish. Well,
yeah, when I wanted to be multilingual for a bit.
Yeah, so Duolingo is it's just one application of different ways that you can apply.
I was even thinking of Snapchat and the way Gen Z are obsessed with their streaks on Snapchat.
Ooh, tell me about that. I don't use Snapchat, so.
So my cousin, who, I think she's 15, I want to say. Yeah, she's 15. So she is obsessed with streaks and a lot of her friends are. And they would literally just like send each other an emoji every day to keep up their streaks. But basically, when you said streaks, that's the first thing that came to mind. Because literally, they will go on Snapchat, they'll message a few people, and then they have like streaks for like a thousand days. So they've been messaging each other for 1,000 days on Snapchat purely to keep up that streak.
Yeah.
And if they lose a streak, it's like horrifying. And it's obviously quite smart from Snapchat because it keeps them coming back. And when they do the streaks,
I know.
They with the one person, and then they get distracted in the app, and then it just equals more time spent in the app. They can serve them with more ads, so on and so forth. So that was like the first thing that came to my mind, actually, when you said the streak thing. But yeah, Duolingo, that's another way as well.
And when you mentioned Snapchat, I also thought of the Bible app.
The Bible app,
I know.
I had to sever that tie because I caught myself one time, I would just go on it.
just keep moving the streaks.
And I was like, you know what? This ain't doing that for me.
Yeah.
But now I don't even look at it.
Because I guess at the end, it's about like the numbers. Mm. And I mean, it is dangerous, like how we then tie that to like, you know, say confidence or, you know, it's like, oh, you have a tick for one day.
Yeah,
type of thing. It can really mess with our, with like our motivations and the real reason behind doing things. Mm-hmm. But it is helpful still in some way, because I guess it helps to build habits, which you're talking about before.
Yeah, and it's, yeah, that is a very valid point, because when we talk about motivation, so going back to the whole psychology behind it, so when we talk about motivation, we have like extrinsic motivation and then intrinsic motivation. So extrinsic motivation is kind of like those external rewards or, you know, punishments for doing something. So people doing things because of what they would get from it. And then there's the intrinsic motivation, which is the ideal situation that we want from people. We want people to be doing things because they want to do them. And for people to be able to do those things because they want to do them means that that activity is, you have to satisfy. So I don't want to go too deep into the research that I did, but it's like there are core needs that have to be satisfied for that intrinsic motivation to happen. So there's, you know, your autonomy, you have to feel like you have a choice, there is relatedness, and there's competence, you have to feel like, you know, you can do it. Relatedness is like the communal part of it, you know, the people part of it. So my research was kind of taking, like I said, the principles of gaming. And what is it that motivates people? What is it that makes people do, or what is it that makes people want to game for the reason of gaming? People don't game because they want to collect coins. There are people that do that. That's also part of my research, like understanding different type of users. But mostly people go there just for the pleasure of what gaming is. But if we can kind of see how even those extrinsic rewards play into how it helps us build intrinsic motivations, then maybe we can get people to do things. So mine was specifically in learning. How can we get people to learn more? Again, going back to Duolingo, the badges, the leaderboards, the streaks, the treasure hunts, there are different ways, there are different things that people use in gamification. So my research was essentially, who are the different types of people, how, what motivates them? And if we took the parts that motivate them and we gave it to them, would it be more beneficial to them than if we gave them game elements that did not apply to them or that did not appeal to them? Mm-hmm. So say, for instance, there's a framework that had already been created that identified the different types of people in a gaming system. Mm-hmm. So you have people who are socializers, who are there to make friends, they're there to, you know, or community. Even to kill people. Yeah, or people that are competitive, that are there, you know, to make sure that, you know, they're killing people. And there are people that are there just for the sake of exploring the game. Anyways, this is just a lot of information. But essentially, my research was kind of like understanding those different types of users and saying, okay, this gamification element, if we applied it to each person, based on their personality type, how does it affect their motivation for learning? How does it help them learn more? So if a person, for instance, is a social type and we give them gamification elements that are not social, would it affect their motivation? Would it affect how they relate with the learning system? Or if a person is a more autonomous person, a more autonomous kind of learner, and we give them something more social, would it affect, you know, them? Something that research has consistently found out is that leaderboards motivate some people, but it is also demotivating for some people. Some people find out that when they are not on the leaderboard, it demotivates them and they don't do it anymore. While some people, even if they're not on the leaderboard, they will do everything to make sure that they get to the top. So just accounting for these different users, and giving them what works for them.
Yeah.
And I think that's just something that generally I think has been interesting me for a long time now, is even in terms of AI, for instance, is that everybody doesn't use technology in the same way. There are differences in how we perceive the world. There are differences in our personalities.
Mm-hmm.
So how can technology understand that? And how can the system change based on those kinds of information? Exactly. Like recommender systems.
As you were speaking, it was like, I completely understand what you're saying. Like, there are different things that motivate us. Like, even if you think about it from a career point of view, there's different things that motivate people to be in different roles. How do you then account for that when you're building an app, for example, or a website? How do you account for all those differences? Can you? I guess you can, because you've got companies like Apple, Google, Microsoft who do so successfully that they manage to appeal to a wide range of people with like the applications, their devices.
Yeah,
that's a good way to break it down, because I know I was saying a lot of things, but that's a good way to break it down, that, you know, understanding the or accounting for those individual differences.
So yeah,
because while they are
experience,
personalized, thank you, that is the word, literally. Personalized experience. So.
What are you most excited about with respect to HCI?
Brain computer interfaces.
Wait, sorry, brain. Are you talking about that chip that Elon Musk has been talking about? Because that comes under concern for me.
You think? Well, I guess it depends on how you look at it. It is an intrusive technology when you think about it. But it's like, I want to see. All man's means is another man's poison.
For real. Explain to us, please. What did you define it as?
Brain computer interfaces.
Okay. Why are you excited about it?
Yeah, I'm excited about it because there are subtle things that we can pick up. The human brain is very fascinating, right? There are subtle things that we can pick up that the human brain can tell us, and we can use to make people's experiences easier. So, like you said, it is concerning. It borders on being concerning, because it's like, people don't have to tell you, like, you know, with normal interfaces, it's like you type or you touch it and then it does. But in this case, it's like the action and the feedback, everything is there.
So you want to tap into my electrical impulses and the chemical balances on my brain.
I want to.
Well, I'm not giving you access. Maybe Tolu will, but me, I'm not doing.
I'll give you access if the end goal is good. So that's what.
I think.
Look at you, Tolu. Amazing.
Well, but that's the thing. But that's why you can't trust humans. You can't trust anybody else but yourself. So
That's why we have to set up ethical frameworks, because you can't trust people. And I think for people who are less able-bodied,
like people who can't communicate conventionally,
or
unable to communicate at all, this could be a way. Okay, I'm coming over slightly. I see why you would be excited. No, that's really cool. I think that is a fantastic way to round up that segment. Amazing. Loved it. Really, really cool stuff. Thank you. Learned a lot there. And now the question is, have our listeners understood what human computer interaction is now? And as always, we leave that question up to you, listeners. So please let us know what you think. If you understand it, if you have any questions, hit us up and we would love to know what you think. So at this point, we will just ask if you have any resources. You can share those with us and we'll include it in the description box for people who want to learn more. You mentioned some documentaries there on Netflix, which we've mentioned previously, Social Dilemma. And yeah, anything else you want to share, we'll also include in the description.
Okay. Yeah, I also have like tons of resources.
That's good.
So it depends on who the target audience is. If this is someone who is like, I want to delve more into HCI, into whatever it is we talked about, or someone who is just curious, what do you think the target person is for this resource?
I think both, actually.
Yeah, literally, so, like, both.
You can summarize.
Okay. Should I give it to you now, or I should give that to you?
Do both. Anything that comes to the top of your head, you can say now. Otherwise, we put it in the description box anyway, so people can refer to it.
Okay.
Yeah.
So for anyone who is interested in, say, human AI interaction design, Google has this resource or guidelines on designing human AI interaction. Yeah, I think that's then for anyone who wants to go into UX or learn more about, say, interaction design or HCI, the Interaction Design Foundation, they have courses and they have like really good resources on that.
Okay, I think that's...
And then they should listen to Let's Talk Tech.
Thank you. Yeah, loud it. We should have given you a microphone.
Bye, guys.
Bye. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Let's Talk Tech. We hope that you have found this episode to be useful and that you are inspired to go and learn more about HCI. Please follow us on @aftergradgist on Instagram. Check us out. Leave a comment, your questions, reviews, topics that you'd like us to discuss. And we would be looking forward to hearing from you. Until next time.
Bye.